Most students obeyed the principal's rules and flocked like sheep when wolves are on the prowl. But a few maverick friends and I deliberately strayed from the herd. While wandering about the zoo, in awe of the caged animals, and at the same time feeling caged ourselves, we came upon a baboon cage in front of which stood a cluster of white school children in preppy green and white uniforms. "Look!" cried one of them in Afrikaans as he saw us coming. From the startled look on his face, there was little doubt he was seeing black schoolboys for the first time in his life. The same could be said about the rest of his colleagues. "Here come the small baboons!" yelped another white boy. "Let's turn back," someone in our group suggested. "Yes, why don't we?" a voice said in support. "We don't want to get into any trouble. Let's go see the lions over there instead." "No," 18-year-old Phineas, leader of our group, said in a defiant tone. "We paid too much money not to see everything in this fucking zoo." "Yes," I gnashed my teeth. "Let's go. We have as much right as they to see the baboons. If they start anything, we'll respond in kind." "Are you mad?" another boy said. "Or do you want to get expelled?" "Those who aren't cowards," Phineas said, "and will come with Johannes and me, over to this side." The group divided into two roughly equal factions. Phineas boldly led us toward the white boys and the baboon cage while the other slunk away.
"Hey, cake! Look, the little baboons are coming to be with the big baboons," shrieked one white boy. And his mates roared with laughter.
There was no adult among them, except some distance away, in front of a cage filled with playful spider monkeys, a tall, wiry man with silver-rimmed glasses stood bemused. He was wearing the same colors as the white boys. We disregarded his presence and jostled our way through the startled white boys to the front of the cage. One of the white boys cursed, "Bloody gaffer," as I deliberately kicked him in the shin. "Gaffer is your mother," I said in Tsonga. My friends heard me and roared with laughter. The white boys didn't know what to do. They couldn't understand a single word of Tsonga, it seemed. Yet we understood everything they were saying in Afrikaans. Pretending to be talking about baboons, we proceeded to compare the mothers, fathers, grandmothers, and grandfathers of the white boys to the various baboons in the cage. Sensing that we were talking about them, but not understanding what we were saying, the frustrated white boys strung one bloody kafir epithet after another. The headmaster came and took them to the lion's cage. We too soon left, laughing and singing, and rejoined our group. We had triumphed over them. After lunch, we went over to the war museum across from the zoo. We saw among the relics of the many wars South Africa has been involved in relics from the Anglo-Boer War of 1899 to 1902, a colonial war so bitterly and closely fought that it left between the English and the Afrikaners wounds of mutual suspicion and hatred so deep that true reconcilement has never taken place to this day. Chapter 33. Constant police raids caused the family bear business to flounder a year after it was begun. Ultimately, we went out of the business altogether. My father's old vices returned. First the gambling, then the heavy drinking to forget his losses. I found a job as a butcher boy for a Chinese family that owned a chain of stores and butcheries in Alexandra. And my mother worked as a washing girl in one of the neighboring suburbs. She still did not have a permit, but her employer simply overlooked the fact, just like the thousands of other whites who did the same for their servants in similar straits. With my father squandering his money on drink and gambling, my mother became the breadwinner. I helped by using my wages to offset part of my siblings' school costs. Aunt Bushy had, as expected, left school after Standard 6 and was now working at a garment factory on the outskirts of Alexandra. A little while after she started working, she became pregnant. She was unmarried and 18. What was unexpected was Uncle Pete leaving school. He was only 16, but he could not stand seeing Granny work herself to death. And as the only man in the house, Uncle Cheeks was still in prison. He wanted to provide for her. Uncle Pete and Aunt Bushy would have experienced the same difficulties and frustrations in getting work permits as Mother had not Granny bribed black policemen who specialized in getting people illegal documents. These blacks were so many, yet were never caught, because white officers either condoned or were part of the scheme. Granny used her life savings for the bribes. My mother became pregnant again. She had no money for maternity care and diapers, so she continued working until the baby was born. The little my father had given her over the course of her pregnancy had gone toward food, rent, bribes, whenever she was arrested during a police raid, and paying for Flora's and George's schooling. When the baby girl, named Lena, finally arrived, the family was dead broke, and my mother had to beg for money to buy diapers and baby food and medicine. One Monday at 4 in the morning, my father woke me up and said, in an embarrassed tone, "Can you lend me 30 cents for bus fare so I can go to work?" He had lost every penny of his wages at Dice over the weekend. He had asked everyone in the yard to loan him some money. They had refused. "I don't have any money," I said. "But I saw you counting pennies and shillings last night," he retorted. "So what?" I said. "It's my money, and I have plenty of uses for it." I said all this in an angry tone, for my father had gone on gambling despite my mother begging him for some money to buy clothes for the infant. "Don't talk to me like that," he bellowed. "I'm your father, you know? So what?" I said arrogantly. His tough talk no longer frightened me, and he knew it. At that moment, I had more money in my pocket than his net worth, and I wasn't going to give him a penny of it, even if he were to fall on his knees and beg me. "I need to go to work, son," he tried to smooth talk me. "Just give me 15 cents for one way. I'll ask for 15 cents return fare from my friends at work. If they don't give me, I'll simply sleep in one of the factory buildings and come back Friday. I'll give you your 15 cents back with interest. I'll give you a rand. My boy, what do you say?" "Just let me go back to sleep, will you?" I said. "I don't owe you any money." "I said, lend me some." "I don't have any," I said, grabbing my pants from a chair nearby, in case he should have ideas. The money in my pocket jingled. "Aha! What's that?" my father cried, and his eyes gleamed under the flickering candle. "I told you you had some money. Let me have some." He extended his gaunt hand anticipatingly. "I'll miss the bus." "I have use for this money," I said, folding my pants and tucking them under the pillow. "All of it?" "All of it. On what?" "On books and baby food." "Damn the books and baby food. I want to go to work." "I'm not stopping you." "Give me the money, damn you," he screamed. I lost my temper. "It's my damn money and I've use for it," I screamed back. "Are you screaming at me?" my father said, incredulous. "At me? Your father? You, my own flesh and blood?" he stammered. "This school business has taught you to be cheeky, I see. Because you're working and making a few pennies, you think you're a man. Huh? Well, let me tell you, my boy, let me tell you. I'm still man around here," he beat his chest. "I call the shots. Either you give me the money or leave my house right at this minute. Without a word, I stood up, dressed, gathered my books, and left for Granny's place. It was 5 o'clock in the morning. I'll cut you down to size yet, my boy, my father shouted after me. Wait until I send you to the mountain school back in the homelands, where they'll teach you respect. Just you wait and see. I stayed at Granny's a week and then returned home. My father said nothing, but I sensed that he was planning some sort of retaliation. I was ready for anything. He couldn't donder whip me as he used to when I was a child, for I was growing stronger and more stubborn every day. We both knew that we were on a collision course. I was set in my ways, he in his. He disparaged education, I extolled it. He burned my books at every opportunity, I bought more. He abused my mother, I tried to help her. He believed all that the white men said about him, I did not. He lived for the moment, I for the future, uncertain as it was. It soon became evident that the reason my father lived for the moment was because he was terrified of the future, terrified of facing the reality that I was on the way to becoming a somebody in a world that regarded him as a nobody, a world that had stripped him of his manhood, of his power to provide. Years of watching him suffer under the double yoke of apartheid and tribalism convinced me that his was a hopeless case, so long as he persisted in clinging to tribal beliefs and letting the white men define his manhood. His suffering convinced me that there was no way he could come to understand reality the way I did, let alone understand the extremes of emotions which had become so much a part of me and were altering my perspective toward life, that I no longer seemed his son, and he, to me, seemed no longer the father whose blood still ran in my veins. By pining for the irretrievably gone days of drums, of warriors, of loinskins, of huts, and of wife buying, I knew he could never travel in thought and in feeling the course my life was embarking upon, because everything he wholeheartedly embraced, I rejected with every fiber of my being. The thick veil of tribalism which so covered his eyes and mind and heart was absolutely of no use to me, for I believed beyond a shadow of a doubt that black life would never revert to the past, that the clock would never turn back to a time centuries ago when black people had lived in peace and contentment before the coming of the white man. Failure to tear away that veil had turned my father into an anachronism. Ignorance and tribalism claimed him so wholly, mind, body and soul, that he was baffled why the world, his wife, his children were seemingly turned against him. Even as he wasted away, trying desperately but in vain to establish order to the chaos of his life, he failed to realize, even in the slightest, that this chaos was partly of his own creation, of his continued clinging to values which had long outlived their usefulness, while at the same time attempting to function in a world the white man had long ago changed for his purposes, progress, and whims. Tribal ways and ignorance so ruled supreme over my father's life, and over many of those of his generation, that for as long as I was to know him, he was like some specter wallowing in the bottomless hole of unreality, groping in it, trying with great futility to surface from it, to materialize into reality. Chapter 34. When Mrs. Smith gave me an old wood tennis racket one Saturday after I had done what she called a splendid job in cleaning her silver and brassware and shining Mr. Smith's half a dozen pairs of shoes, I was already beginning to get bored with soccer. Practice hard, she said, for one day I want to read about you in the papers as our next Arthur Ashe.
I don't know if I can be like him, madam, I said apologetically. He's good.
I'd been reading about Arthur Ashe's exploits in the old tennis magazines Mrs. Smith regularly gave me. I couldn't even begin to imagine how a black man could become so good in a sport dominated by whites. Besides, what kind of a black man was he to be allowed to mix with whites, compete against them, even beat them? What kind of society did he live in which allowed a black man to become rich and famous at the expense of whites, instead of the other way around? How could I begin teaching myself tennis? I was almost 14 years old, had never handled a tennis racket in my life, and knew absolutely nothing about the rules of the game. What I had read in the tennis magazines simply confounded rather than enlightened me. I began pounding the tennis wall at the Alexandra Stadium. The one thing I liked about tennis was that it was not a team sport like soccer. My success and improvement depended upon my own efforts. At Beauvais, there was no tennis, but I heard that the sport was played in some of the black colleges throughout the country. Would I ever get to college? Following the folding of the beer business, the economic situation in the house had worsened. My mother continued to work, but there was now another mouth to feed. I had left my job at the butchery and was now doing piecework for Mrs. Smith and a few of her neighbors on weekends, washing cars, weeding gardens, shining shoes, cleaning silverware, cleaning pools, and so on. All my earnings went toward feeding the family and paying for my schooling. One evening while sitting by the table reading a torn copy of Alan Paton's Cry the Beloved Country, I turned my eyes at my mother kneeling by the brazier, cooking porridge, Lena strapped to her back and bowling. My mother looked so worn out, I thought, the result of her working long hours for white people who, she said, worked like a mule, treated her like vermin, yet paid her nothing. Ma, I said, closing the book, I'm going to leave school as soon as I finish Standard 6.
Why?
Because you have 6 children and a useless husband to look after. I want to help.
I can manage.
No, Ma, I said, you think you can, and you believe you should, but you can't do it alone. You need help. So you want to quit school just at the time when you're doing so well? Is that it, child? What happened to your dreams of someday becoming a teacher or a doctor?
I can still do that through correspondence school.
What job do you hope to get if you leave school now?
Anything a Standard 6 graduate can do, which is what?
Picking up garbage for white people?
Delivery boy?
Is that what you've endured 8 years in school for? Is that what I've sacrificed so much for?
I can work in a factory, I said, just like Uncle Pete.
Is that what your heart really wants to do?
I know that's not what you want to do.
How do you know my mind?
I'm your mother, remember, she said. I carried you in my womb for 9 months. You sucked from my breast. I saw you learn how to crawl and take your first walking steps. Child, I know you more than you know yourself.
She was right. I didn't want to drop out of school after Standard 6, if I could help it. I wanted to continue on to Form 1, 2, 3, then do 2 years of matriculation, then on to university to study engineering or medicine. I badly wanted to do that. No one in the family had done it. That was my dream. But at the same time, I couldn't bear to watch my mother kill herself as she struggled against impossible odds to keep the family alive. If I were to work, no matter at how menial a job, I could at least help her. I could make sure that my brother and sisters got all the education they wanted. I could compensate for my shattered dreams by helping them realize theirs.
I want you to go on if you pass Standard 6,
my mother said after a long pause. Where will the money come from?
From somewhere, she said.
I'll even break my back if that's what it takes to keep you going.
Why, Ma?
Because I want you to become educated, that's all.
But I'm educated, I countered.
No, you aren't, she said emphatically. I might not have gone to school, but I can tell an educated person when I see one. My mother and I continued arguing until we reached a compromise. I would continue on to secondary school only on condition that I obtained a first-class pass. Otherwise, I would don overalls and begin working at one of the factories ringing Alexandra. Had I been able to find part-time jobs to fill my spare time, I probably wouldn't have continued playing tennis. As it turned out, part-time jobs were as scarce as money to pay for school. The more I read about the world of tennis and Arthur Ashe's role in it, the more I began to dream of its possibilities. What if I too were someday to attain the same fame and fortune as Arthur Ashe? Would whites respect me as they did him? Would I be as free as he? The dreams were tantalizing, but I knew they were only dreams. Nevertheless, I kept on dreaming. After all, what harm could that do me? One weekday afternoon, I was at the stadium practicing against the wall when a big colored man with a face full of freckles approached the court. He leaned against its fence and watched me play.
Hit that backhand! Hit that backhand! He said insistently. Don't run around it!
I tried hitting one backhand. The stroke was horrible. I returned to only working my forehand, my best stroke.
You fool, the colored man said. Practice that backhand or you might just as well forget about tennis.
Have you no common sense? Don't you know you never work on your strength but your weakness? And your backhand is atrocious. The man's name was Scaramouche. He resented being called colored, but according to apartheid, that was his official designation as one of over 2 million people of mixed race who were more than a blemish to the white man's theory of racial purity. According to the government, coloreds were neither black nor white. Even though some of them were as black as the blackest black man, or as white as the whitest white man. Coloreds were allowed to live with blacks, though special areas had been set aside for them under the Group Areas Act. The government generally treated coloreds slightly better by giving them better jobs, better housing, and better education than blacks. As a result, most of the coloreds were ashamed of their black blood, and often their prejudice against blacks was fiercer than the white men's. But a new generation of young coloreds, which saw itself as more black than white, was emerging, and it embraced the entire range of black aspirations. Scaramouche, a self-employed painter, was one of the best tennis players among people of color in Johannesburg. An excellent coach, he was well connected in white and black tennis circles. He evaluated my game this way. I had potential to become a decent player provided I was prepared to work hard to unlearn the numerous bad habits I had taught myself. He agreed to be my coach.
Part 3. Passport to Freedom. Chapter 35. It was only a matter of time before tennis replaced soccer as my favorite sport. Scaramouche turned out to be not only a good coach, but a confidant and a surrogate father. He was firm and demanding, but not authoritative and stifling. Instead of teaching me his style of play, which would have been easy for him to do, he let me acquire my own. He was lavish with praise when deserved, but was a severe critic of sloppiness and laziness. Whenever I visited his home on Second Avenue, we often talked about the state of black tennis.
Through Scaramouche, I learned that the South African National Lawn Tennis Union, SANALTU, an organization that ran black tennis, was so underfunded, so understaffed, its officers so embroiled in a power struggle, that it could manage to host only a handful of badly run tournaments a year. This was in stark contrast to the white tennis body, SALTU, South African Lawn Tennis Union, which had the best facilities and administrators, almost limitless funding, and hosted close to 1,000 tournaments of mostly professional caliber each year. Scaramouche would often say, "You know, my boy, if we blacks had half the money and coaches as white people, we would have long produced several Arthur Ashes, Althea Gibsons, and Yvonne Goolagongs." Scaramouche regularly gave me tennis instruction manuals and magazines. Soon I knew so much about the history of tennis that had the criteria for success in the game been knowledge of its history, I would certainly have been a superstar. I even knew the history of such players as Suzanne Langlin and Bill Tilden. My life began revolving around school, reading, and tennis. On rainy days, I would play shadow tennis, hitting an imaginary tennis ball. I became so wrapped up in the game that my mother issued the following warning: "Tennis isn't everything, Johannes. Don't forget, school is more important." "I won't, Ma," I said, and went ahead anyway, thinking that men could live by tennis alone. My father regarded tennis as a sissy sport. He would have been thrilled had I shown an interest in tribal war games in which men and boys fought each other with spears and nopgiris. "So," he said one evening as I was busy putting shoe polish on my sneakers, "not only are you trying to become a woman by crying and not bearing pain like a man, but I see you also trying to become an imitation white man by playing this silly thing called tennis. Whites have no monopoly on tennis." "I really doubt if you are my son, you know that?" he said. "There is no way I could have fathered a wimp." "Leave me alone," I said angrily. "By playing this thing tennis," he went on, "especially against women, one would indeed think you were a woman who only happened to have a penis. Just leave me alone." "Aha! You mad because it's true, is that not so?" he said with a grin. "Well, all is not lost yet. There's still a way to cure you of all the books, all the tennis, and all the white man's behavior." To avoid further confrontation, I left the room. Chapter 36. That my mother's suffering at the hands of my father had led me to form an alliance with her to oppose his tyranny was true. That on most occasions I was more likely to listen to her advice than his, I made no bones about. And finally, that my life was taking its shape and meaning largely due to her efforts and encouragement went without saying. Yet, there was one area in which she failed to exert any influence on me: religion. She had now become a devout member of the Full Gospel Church of God on 12th Avenue. Every Sunday, she would take George and my sisters there to sing hymns of praise to the Lord and ask for renewal of strength to face and overcome the trial and tribulations strewn about our lives like grains of sand on the seashore. I flatly refused to sit under some leaking roof listening to a demagogue out to make money by sending people on guilt trips and pretending to speak in tongues. That was the nature of some preachers in Alexandria. whose extremely obedient flocks were variously known as the Donkey Church, the Seven Wives Church, the 100 Rand Net Worth Church. I frowned upon organized religion for the simple reason that about me I saw it being misused by the government in claiming that God had given whites the divine right to rule over blacks, that our subservience was the most natural and heavenly condition to be in, by some black churches to strip ignorant black peasants of their last possessions in the name of payment for the salvation of their souls, and by the same churches to turn able-bodied men and women into flocks of sheep, making them relinquish responsibility for their lives in the hope that faith in Christ would miraculously make everything turn out right. Worst of all, I found among members of some churches a readiness to accept their lot as God's will, a willingness to disparage their own blackness and heritage as inferior to the white man's Christianity, a readiness to give up fighting to make things just in this world, in the hope that God's justice would prevail in the hereafter, that the hungry and the oppressed and the enslaved of this world would feast on cornucopias while singing freedom songs and hosanna in a heaven without prejudice. In short, organized religion made blacks blind to, or avoid or seek to escape from, reality. Maybe my mother did see reality in all its shades and colors, and was simply using organized religion to cultivate qualities like patience, resiliency, fortitude, hope, and optimism. I do not know. All I know is that I wanted to carry the burden of my own life, to use whatever talent I had to carve a niche in a world where the odds were against my doing so. I instinctively knew that organized religion would hinder rather than help me, would torpedo my best laid plans. My mother tried to convince me that the preacher, herself, and myself should work together as a trio to accomplish these goals I had set myself in life. But I wouldn't be convinced. What did the preacher know about tennis? Don't you think God has some influence on the way your life is turning out? She said one night after I had just finished reading her scriptures. Because she could not read, my mother always requested that I read her several verses every night before she went to sleep. I gladly obliged. That was the least I could do at the moment to show appreciation for all she had done and was doing for me. Besides, I loved reading the Bible, mainly for the beauty and richness of its language, the earthy wisdom contained in many of its passages, and that sharpness which comes to the mind when one listens to the case of the existence of God being persuasively argued by men and women of different viewpoints who walked this earth in time immemorial. "I have no way of telling, Ma," I said, "except that I do somehow believe there is something more powerful than man out there in the universe. Some call it a force, some call it God, some call it luck. What do you call it?" "I call it the force," I said, laughing. "Do you think the force may be working through our pastor, for instance?" "I doubt that very much," I said. "But I've no way of telling." "Putting it another way, do you think the force is in the church?" "Maybe." "Then why don't you come?" "I didn't say it's present only in churches. It could be right here in this house, for instance. As a matter of fact, I believe it is, I said, a smile on my face. Otherwise, how does one account for the fact that Papa hasn't killed all of us yet, himself included in the bargain, as he's threatened so many times to do? You know he doesn't mean it. I can't be that sure. Can I go to bed now? Read me another verse, the last one, Corinthians 13. One of the migrant workers for whom I read and wrote letters was a short, barrel-chested, pock-marked-faced man named Limela, who hated and distrusted Christianity so much that the mere mentioning of it, or the mere sight of evangelists who went about the township from house to house expounding the doctrine, would send him into a fitful rage. He made it a personal crusade to visit Chibin's regularly. And there, amid intense beer drinking and boisterous talk, denounced Christianity as a clever ploy through which whites sought to keep blacks forever slaves. His repudiations of Christianity had as their launching pad the popular African expression, "When the white people came, we had the land and they had the Bible. Now we have the Bible and they have our land." An expression he always used to accuse priests, pastors, evangelists, and Jehovah's Witnesses of collaborating with what he called descendants of treacherous white missionaries. He was illiterate and had a wife and 6 children back in a tribal reserve. His wife regularly wrote him lengthy, urgent, and impassioned letters requesting money for food, clothing, rent, medicine, school fees, books, seeds, and money to repair broken plows and leaking roofs. One evening, I was in his leaking shack reading him the bad news that his few lean cattle back in the tribal reserve had been confiscated by authorities there as partial payment for outstanding rent on the plot of land his wife and children lived on, and that they were facing eviction if the rest of the rent wasn't paid on time, when, after a faint knock, in walked a short, dumpy black man with tufts of crinkly, graying hair, dressed in a green and white frock with sleeves up to the elbows. He had no shoes on. Following closely behind him was an equally short and plump black woman. She, too, was dressed in an outfit similar to the men's, except hers had a few cheap embroideries. The two clutched stacks of pamphlets in their hands. "Not you again!" Limera exclaimed in fury as the two walked in. The man, already a foot or so inside the shack, cleared his throat while the woman stood silently by the doorway, and said, "Can we sit down?" "No," Limera said indignantly. The evangelist sat down anyway, on a makeshift bench of bricks and planks. "I told you never to set foot in my house again, Mfundisi, preacher," Limela raged. "I don't want to hear any more about your white God. Why then do you keep on coming? Do you think because you call yourself man of God, I won't kick your ass?" "I'll gladly let you kick my ass for the glory of God," the Mfundisi said humbly. "We are his shepherds, and are expected to go after even the wildest sheep." "God loves you, you know," shrieked the woman. "You may hate the white man, but do not hate God." "Who's this God? Who's this God?" Limela fumed. "Isn't he a white man's God?" "God is colorblind," said the Mfundisi. "White people too need to come to him so he can forgive them their sins." Limela was beside himself with rage. "You are stuck raving mad, Mfundisi," he declared with flaming eyes. "You mean to tell me that white people aren't aware of what they're doing to us? You mean to tell me they aren't aware that my family is starving because of their laws? Do you mean to tell me that God will forgive them all that? Any God who'll forgive white people's sins is as mad as you are, Mfundisi. Their brows shiny with perspiration. The evangelists sat speechless as Lemela unleashed his blasphemous tirade, drawing parallel after parallel between Christianity and witchcraft. I enjoyed every minute of the confrontation. Perversely, I wish Lemela would throw the Mfundisi out. "They keep on returning, my boy," Lemela said, shaking his head despairingly. "And each time they tell me, in different ways, and each way more devious than the last, that this God of theirs forgives all sins, be they a black man's or a white man's. Boy, would you, if you were God, forgive white people for what they're doing to us?"
"Never," I said.
"Don't lead the children astray now, Lemela," said the Mfundisi. "Jesus said, let the children..." I cut him short. "I'm not a bloody child, mister, and I'm going to no fucking Jesus." Warming up, I continued. "I know people of your kind. You are dirty, stinking liars. You make people forget reality and dream about some stupid heaven no one really knows exists. If people like Lemela don't confront reality in the face, who'll do it for them, eh? Tell me, who? Who'll fight for their rights, their honor, their dignity? And let me tell you this too. You and your kind are also cheats and thieves. How often do you, Mfundisi, and your kind strip people of everything they've got in the name of salvation? You would even rob them of their souls if you could get at them." "My child," the Mfundisi said with stupefied eyes, "ignorant as you are, your soul right now is tumbling into hell. By blaspheming against God and his holy word, you are committing a sin so huge one hell won't be enough for your damned soul to roast in."
"Don't give me that rubbish, Mfundisi," I sneered. "We all know that the existence of God is a matter of speculation. The Bible is nothing but a collection of stories by whites."
"You'll burn in hell," the Mfundisi declared. "I'm already going through hell under the white man's rule," I said. "So another ordeal in hell won't make much of a difference. I wonder where you'll end up, cheat and liar, betrayer of your own people." The Mfundisi's jaws dropped and he stared at me stupidly. The woman emitted gasps of horror. I became self-conscious and turned my eyes away from the two.
"Is that so?" Lemela grinned triumphantly. "So the Bible is nothing but a simple storybook. I thought so. The white man's storybook. We blacks don't need the white man's tales, do we, boy? We have our own better ones, don't we?"
I nodded. The Mfundisi had apparently regained his composure, for he said, in an inspired voice, sweeping his arms toward heaven, "It's not too late for both you two to escape from the clutches of Diablos." I marveled at his courage. "The kingdom of heaven is yours if you only allow me and my sister in Christ here to exorcise by prayer the evil spirits raging inside you. That way you'll be counted among those lucky ones who'll someday soon enjoy the overflowing bliss of the glorious life to come."
"Which life to come, liar?" I said angrily. "Which life to come? There's only one life, and this is it. And how are black people faring in it? Are we enjoying it like white people are? Are we getting Rolls Royces, mansions, and swimming pools from it? Or are we getting hunger, disease, poverty, and suffering? Why are you without shoes? Is it because walking on streets strewn with sharp rocks, thorns, and broken bottles is a thrill? Tell me, Mfundisi, why are white people having their paradise in this world,
instead of suffering like us in anticipation of eternal bliss. You know why? They're smart. They know the game, for they invented it. Tell them, my boy, cheered Lemera, clapping his hand. Tell them good. Child, the Mfundisi said, you must be born of the devil. Before I could insult the evangelist further, Lemera said, Mfundisi, I don't need your God. My gods are the spirits of my ancestors. Those things are impotent, said the Mfundisi. They can do nothing to save your soul from eternal damnation. Lemela sprang to his feet and cocked his fist. Get out of my house, you bastard, he screamed at the Mfundisi. Get out before I fling you out. Silently, the Mfundisi and the woman rose and left. However, they intentionally left a couple pamphlets on the bench where they were sitting. What's that, boy? Lemela asked, as he saw me perusing the pamphlet. Oh, another pack of lies. So-called testimonials of black people who recount their meetings with God. Another of the white men's tricks, eh? Lemela said. I'm shivering, boy. What about us making a cozy little fire outside? I understood what he meant. He wanted to use the pamphlets to make a fire. We stepped outside. The night was cold and the sky overcast. We gathered some wood and cardboard. The pamphlets made a roaring fire. Chapter 37. One winter evening, while I was reading Drum magazine under candlelight, my father burst through the front door, accompanied by two pitch-black men as huge and wild as grizzly bears. My mother was in the other room helping George and my sisters try on some second-hand clothes she had bought at a jumble sale. There he is, shouted my father the minute he saw me, as if he were a witch doctor accusing a villager of witchcraft. Get him! The two men started toward me. Instinctively, I leaped from the chair, grabbed a long knife that had been on the table and stood against the wall. My mother heard the voices and came running to the kitchen. What's going on? She asked. These men have come to take him to circumcision school, my father declared, a smile of deep satisfaction playing on his lips. Under Venda tribal law, every boy, before being admitted into malehood, had to attend a mountain school, usually situated in wooded, mountainous areas remote from the villages. During attendance at the school, the proselytes are put through various rituals by a group of circumcised men, including the main ceremony where the boys' penises are cut by razors without anesthesia. My mother stuttered. What led you to decide this without telling me? She asked. He's my child, my father said. And mine also, returned my mother. He's become too cheeky around my house, my father railed. It's time he went to the mountain school to learn his proper role. He's not taking after me. Take after you! I cried. Take after you! What have you done that I could emulate? Your drinking? Your gambling? Your ignorance? Your irresponsibility? I'd rather be dead than be like you, I spat. Hear how he talks to me, his father. He even spits at me. Okay now, boy, growled one of the men. Put that knife down and come quietly. You'll only be gone for 3 months. 3 months! Exclaimed my mother. You can't afford to be gone that long. Exams are coming up soon. This is the most important exam of his life, Musadi, said one of the men. He is to be tested for his manhood. Maybe he can go next year. I'm not going anywhere ever, I said. If I need to be circumcised, I'll go to the clinic. I'll kill anybody that dares lay a hand on me. He's only bluffing, my father said. He won't use that knife. Try me. I gnashed my teeth. The man hesitated. He's a tsotsi, my mother said. The two strangers exchanged glances. Talk to your son, Jackson, said one of them. We'll come back tomorrow and pick him up. They left, and my father left with them. I immediately packed my books and clothes and left for Granny's place, where I stayed for 2 weeks and then returned home. The issue of circumcision school never came up between me and my father, but there was no doubt that the incident had strained our relationship to a breaking point. He seldom talked to me, and I never as much as breathed a word to him. Living like this turned me into a nervous wreck. I began to experience problems with my health. Without money to go to a doctor, I had no way of finding out what was ailing me. My imagination told me that my father was trying to poison me. I became paranoid. I thought I would go insane. I was only 14. Despite being under considerable stress because of the bad blood between my father and me, I went ahead and set for the Standard 6 final exams. I had to do very well in these exams, for there was a possibility I could win a scholarship to help me on to secondary school. Under normal circumstances, I would not have doubted my ability to do very well in an exam. In my 8 years of school, I had never placed below the top 1% in any class. But the falling out with my father had left me demoralized and without confidence. I felt I would be lucky to pass. I conferred with my mother about my plight, and as always, she had an encouraging word. She was the eternal optimist. Have faith in yourself, child. You've done very well so far. There's no reason you can't do well now. Believe in yourself. I set for the exams with as much confidence as I could muster under the circumstances. When the results came out a few months later, I found myself, along with half a dozen other students, the toast of the school. We were among the highest scorers in all of Alexandra's tribal schools. I had obtained a first-class pass, barely missing the highest honor, distinction. A day after the results appeared in the world, the principal called me to his office, where I found several teachers full of smiles and congratulatory remarks. The principal motioned to my teacher to speak. "You're without doubt one of the best students Beauvais has ever had," he began. "We are all very proud of you. Though I may at times have caned you more than others, I knew deep in my heart that you were a bright student, that with a proper dose of punishment and encouragement, you could achieve great things. I hope you'll retain the spirit of hard work, of curiosity, of doubting, of asking questions, even if you know that answers are impossible. God bless you." Everyone clapped. I was at a loss for words. The principal rescued me by saying with effusive pride, "Johannes, I'm proud to inform you that you've been awarded, based on your academic record, a government scholarship to pay for your schooling for each of the 3 years of secondary school." I could not believe my ears. I did not know whether to jump up and down or cry. How could it have happened? How could I have done it? Was it real? The principal went on, "It's all true, my boy. It couldn't have happened to a more deserving student. It's a fitting crowning achievement to a remarkable career at this school. Your academic records will surely stand for years to come. Of course, there's no need to tell you that the scholarship is contingent upon your continuing to do well academically. Do you think you will?" I was too speechless to say anything. That night, my mother cried tears of joy. "God lives, child. He does live. He does listen to prayers," she sobbed. Granny, Uncle Pete, and Aunt Bushy were informed and promised to help me become the family's first doctor. Even my father said, "Will the government give you a job when you are finished with school?" Had I not hated the tribal reserves, I would have gone with friends from the graduating class to boarding school in Giyani, the tribal reserve for the Tsongas. I chose instead the local secondary school, and as it turned out, that may have been the most important decision of my life. Alexandra Secondary School had a tennis team. Alexandra Secondary School was the only mixed school in the ghetto. Students from various tribal primary schools studied together for the first time. Obviously, the medium of instruction could not be any of the tribal languages. English, as the most common language in the country, was used in teaching mathematics, history, geography, physics, biology, religious instruction, woodworking, and domestic science. Each student's curriculum was rounded off by the Afrikaans, English, and vernacular languages. The school had better facilities than the primary schools, but it lacked many things, and overcrowding was still a serious problem. The motto of the school was Labor Omnia Vincit, labor conquers all. And the dozen or so teachers, along with the principal, ran a tight ship. No drugs, proper uniform every day, corporal punishment to enforce discipline, compulsory cleaning of the school compound, and a decree that English be spoken at all times instead of tribal languages. I could not have been happier with the rules, particularly the last one. Finally, here was a clear opportunity to strive toward mastering the language of John Bull. Because many of the subjects were taught in English, and I had had a head start in the language through my connection with the Smiths, I quickly became one of the better students in school. I came out at the top of the Form 1 class in exams at the end of the first quarter. My performance was above average in all subjects, but I excelled in languages and the sciences. I was on the debating society my first year and was chosen to represent the school in Afrikaans, Tsonga, and English prose and poetry reading during inspection. It was a lot of responsibility, but I still found time to practice tennis. Many of the boys and girls I had grown up with left school because they lacked money to continue. The dropout rate in primary school was 98%. The scholarship I had paid for books and school fees. I had to buy my own uniform and meet all other expenses. This I tried to do by working part-time for the Smiths. The little I made was augmented by help from Aunt Bushy and Uncle Pete. One of these days I'll make you all proud for all the help, I told Uncle Pete after he had bought me a new white shirt and a pair of long grey flannels. Don't worry, nephew, Uncle Pete replied. Just keep up the good work. I doubt that had I been able to stay in school, I would have accomplished half of what you have. Because of you, I'm being recognized in the streets as that smart boy's uncle. Remember the day your exam results appeared in the world? I took a copy with me to work, and you know, I was the envy of the whole factory. White people even greeted me. If you keep up the good work, kid brother, who knows, I may even be promoted. Aunt Bushy, who regularly gave me lunch money and paid for my school trips, said about the same. Granny, always irrepressible, said, as long as I have you, child, I don't need a husband. I couldn't find one as handsome, as brainy, as caring as you in the entire world. Wherever I go nowadays, grandmothers and mothers tell me they have granddaughters and daughters beautiful and smart enough for you to marry. But I say, he's already taken. They ask, who's the lucky girl? And I say, you are looking right at her. The fact that I could rely on getting help from the three whenever I needed it made it easy for me to devote more time to tennis. Improvement was slow. I came up with a regimen to help me play better. I started visiting bookstores in Johannesburg with a notebook in hand and would read scores of tennis and exercise books, jotting down pointers. To improve my concentration and flexibility, I began practicing yoga. To keep my energy level consistently high, I vowed never to become sexually active until I had made it. I had read somewhere that sex drained one's energy and single-mindedness. Much to my surprise, my game began improving. I started triumphing over players at once been trampled by. For the first time since I began playing tennis, I defeated Scaramouche. As if this was not enough to make me worship my secret formula of success, I became the number one player at my school. The year was 1972. In final exams that year, held in December, I led the Form 1 classes. 1973 proved a great tennis year. I was selected captain of the team, played number one in singles and doubles, and led the school to several important victories against long-standing rivals. Scaramouche entered me in a couple of black tournaments held in Soweto, Pretoria, Tembisa, Daveyton, and Kwatema. I did not do well in them, but the experience was valuable. Scaramouche managed to get me a few old tennis rackets from his wealthy white tennis friends, and I was able to concentrate on my game without worrying about a broken racket or string. In June, I met Tom, a lanky Zulu tennis player who had just come out for the tennis team. He immediately stood out from the rest of us because his tennis clothes and rackets were worth at least twice the tennis team's annual budget. Tom was too harmless to be a thief. So one day I asked him where he got the stuff. He started telling me about a tennis ranch in Halfway House, so called because the place was roughly halfway between Johannesburg and Pretoria, where he worked but was about to quit to take up a better offer at another ranch. The tennis ranch in Halfway House was called Barrett's, after the construction company that was one of the major builders of tennis courts in South Africa. A German immigrant named Wilfred Horn ran the place. How long has he been in South Africa? I asked. Not long enough to have turned into an Afrikaner SOB, replied Tom. He grew up during the Second World War and once told me that he thinks the mad ideas of Hitler and his Nazis are the same as the national parties. The ruling Afrikaner Party, the creators of apartheid. Interesting fellow. Wilfred respects black people, Tom said. He and his South African-born wife, Norma, and their four-year-old son, like most whites, have an entourage of sevens, but they treat them well. If they have a tribe of sevens, what do you do? I play tennis, brother, he boasted. I thought you said you worked there. Yes, I work at my tennis game. Who do you play with? Are there black players and black courts at this ranch? No, it's as lily-white as the Boerders Bond, a secret white male society that has produced all of South Africa's leaders. I was the only black there. I played whites. You played against whites? I gasped. Who are you? I'm Tom, just plain simple Tom. Half my mind told me that Tom might be a police informer. Of all the categories of blacks, informers were the one group most likely to enjoy cordial relations with whites. The whites, of course, being the police. Maybe the ranch was nothing but a retreat for white secret agents and black informants. I'm not what you're thinking. Tom interrupted my thought. I'm no Uncle Tom. The members of this ranch are mostly wealthy Germans and English liberals who don't mind. In fact, they like mixing with blacks. The right blacks, that is. Yes, there are a few Afrikaner bigots, but who cares? Anyway, these liberals love me because I'm neat, I'm in secondary school, I can speak English, Afrikaans, and German fluently. What more could white liberals want? If all our people were like me, I strongly believe there would be no need for apartheid. Not among white liberals, anyway. That was his opinion. And you say you are leaving this place? I asked. Yes, at the end of the month, I found a better paradise. Tom, I pray you, I said. Please take me to this paradise you are leaving. Introduce me to Wilfred, and for as long as I live, I'll worship the ground upon which you walk.